Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the latest chapter of Turn the Page, the official podcast of Syosset Public Library. My name is Barney Leventino, and I am very pleased today to welcome Revis Wortham, who is the author of the Red River Mystery Series. First book in the series is The Rock Hole, which was recently reissued. It was published originally in 2011. The latest book in the series, Laying Bones, will be coming out in January. Revis, welcome.
Thank you very much. I sure appreciate you having me on today.
It's a pleasure. First question, and on a personal note, I appreciate the reissue because whenever I talk to authors who have series, I usually get the latest in the series, and I don't like jumping in at the end of a series. This gave me the opportunity to be introduced from the beginning, and hopefully we'll have time between now and January to get through the rest. Why the reissue at this time?
Well, that came from my publisher. The Rock Hole originally came out in 2011, but it came out with a limited release. There were not a lot of copies, although it surprised us all when we got a starred review from Kirkus over right at the outset. That was a shock. And so we didn't expect that many people to be excited about it, as excited as we had hoped, because it's a first novel, and you never know what's going to happen with that first one once it comes out. But people loved it, and it was such a limited release that they wanted to try and bring it back today, since there are a number of other books in the series now with plans to continue onward. So the good folks over at Sourcebooks asked me if I would like for them to re-release it with a new cover. And I'm excited about that cover. It really looks great. And so The Rock Hole is out there for those folks who weren't able to get it at the outset.
You mentioned this is your first novel. What were you doing prior to becoming a novelist? How did you end up here?
Like all novelists, I've been trying for a long, long time. I'm a retired educator of 35 years in the state of Texas. I retired as the director of communication. And as part of my stress relief for that job, I started writing newspaper columns in 1988 just to blow off a little steam. And there were outdoor humor columns that took off quite well here in the state of Texas. By the late 90s, I was self-syndicated in over 50 newspapers across the state and in Oklahoma. So I cut my teeth writing outdoor humor newspaper columns. And then, like everyone else, you work on that first novel and you work on it. And some people get caught in a loop. I got caught in a technological issue after I finished the novel the first time. I was writing it on a 286 computer. I don't know if you remember those with the big floppies. Yeah. Well, no one explained to me that all that writing and rewriting on that floppy was not a good idea. And we had a technical hiccup, and the day I typed the end and hit save that one last time, the screen went blue, and all of a sudden, I have a little note that said, file corrupted. And I panicked. I've been working on that for several years off and on, and took it to a technical friend of mine, and he got one page out. That's all he could recover. And so I came home, bought myself a new computer, and rewrote The Rock Hole from the outset from memory.
How different was this version than the version that you lost?
You know, it's surprising. I'd worked on it for so long, like, you know, most first-time authors. I worked on it for so long that I had almost had all of it memorized. You know, I'd go back and I'd tweak and do these kinds of things. And so I think it's a better version. I learned a number of things. A lot of writers fall into traps, and I fall into a number of traps. One of them is the overuse of adverbs. The overuse of allocations, he said, she said, you know, he asked. I seldom use those in my work. I use action and people's actions and action to let you know who the people are that are speaking. So it's a better novel, but streamlined. It was way too long when I gave it to my first publisher. I didn't know the first thing about writing novels. It was 140,000 words. And she looked at, she says, I love this, but we're going to have to cut some. And I asked her how much. And she said, well, about 50,000 words to make it down to 90. And I almost had a second heart attack over that because I already rewritten it again, you know. So, but I cut it down. It's a much better novel than my first few drafts.
Well, I got to tell you, I've read a lot of books where I wish that their editors had taken that approach because they were just way too long and they didn't need to be. Good books, but they could have been better. The book takes place in 1964 in rural Texas, which I gather is kind of where you grew up.
That's true. I grew up in rural Northeast Texas, partially. My dad worked in Dallas, but our weekends, our vacations, our summers were spent in my a little community that my folks had grown up in. The community was called Shikota, Texas.
Our library is in suburban Long Island, and for most of our listeners and our patrons here at the library, rural Texas in the 60s is just a foreign time and place. So talk to me, tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up then and really kind of compare to what things are like now.
Well, you know, rural Northeast Texas, that area was caught in time. The individuals that that I grew up with, I call them the old men, and they were probably younger than I am today, you know, but they looked old when I was a kid. So these guys, And these women that lived in this community were almost throwbacks to the 30s. They'd survived the Depression, they'd survived World War II, but they didn't give up on a number of things, the way of life that they had grown up with and that their parents had grown up with. And so it was a snapshot in time where the ladies still wore the old flower dresses that could have been worn in the 40s or 30s. We still raised our own food. Had a garden, raised the animals that we ate, the stock that we raised and sold. We had cows, we had the whole thing, but it had not begun to change like the larger towns closer to the bigger cities. The influence was changing. I don't know if you ever heard the numbers, but before World War II, this country was 80% rural and 20% urban, and it flipped by the 1960s. And so you see people struggling to maintain a way of life, rural way of life in a world that was changing. We had Vietnam was just starting to ramp up at that time. And we would hear about it on the evening news, and we had a couple of cousins, or I had a couple of cousins that were drafted and went overseas or volunteered and went overseas. But for the most part, everyone just tried to raise their kids and go to church and be family folks and make enough money to survive till the next day. No one there was looking to get rich, especially cotton farmers or cattle ranchers. You weren't making a lot of money, but you were making a living, and it was a good living out in the country. And that was it. My granddad, he farmed. He would climb on a tractor in the mornings and plow all day, get off the tractor in the evenings, take his overalls off, put on a shirt and a pair of slacks and pin a badge onto his shirt. And then he was the local constable. And so that was the long arm, the reach of the sheriff's department out of those precincts. And he dealt with whatever issues might arise out in the country, as it were. But we sat dirt roads, it was backcountry, and it was a way of life that's so much simpler now than it is now.
You just described to a degree Ned Parker, and an interesting character, and as you say, somebody who was making a living and then also had the badge on. Interesting guy.
That was my granddad. I based the Rock Hole was, I had written it to be a standalone novel. And so I based it on him as a constable dealing with a budding serial killer that he had never experienced before. He didn't even know anything about him. It's based on a true story that I recall. Now you have to remember, this is a 66-year-old guy trying to recall everything that happened when he was 10. So, you know, some of the facts may not be exactly as I remembered, but I was able to weave them into the story of the Rock Hole and make Ned Parker the major character. Now Ned is continued on. He was in his 60s in the Rock Hole in the first novel.
A couple of themes that run through the book, again, this is the early 60s, exploded in the late 60s. You mentioned Vietnam, and one of the primary characters in the book, Cody, was a Vietnam vet who came back from overseas, came back from someplace that people had never heard about and didn't know anything about and couldn't really comprehend what it exactly was that he went through when he was over there. Another issue that permeates the book is, and you deal with it very matter-of-factly, is the systemic racism that existed at the time. And I'm going to come back to that, and I'm referring to it as something that existed, and you deal with it right up front. A lot of authors today seem to be a little hesitant to really describe and use language the way it was used back then, but you don't. And that really adds to the value and the flavor of the book. How did you plan, or did you plan, or did it just happen to approach the racism issue the way that you did?
Yeah, I don't consciously outline. I've never written an outline. Well, I tried an outline one time and got off of it on the second page, so I don't outline. I sit down and put my fingers on the keys, and it is, Mario, it's as if you were writing and it's coming up in front of me. So I'm watching the story unfold truthfully. I don't know what's going to happen. When characters step onto the page, they come in of, it's kind of strange to say, but they almost come in of their own volition. I don't know that they're arriving. I did consciously create John Washington because there was an African-American deputy sheriff there in Paris, Texas, where I grew up. And he was a larger than life guy. I recall him as being as big as Mr. Coffee. What was his name in the stand? The Stephen King novel, The Green Mile, John Coffey. John Washington to me was that big a guy. And I would see him on occasion, and I would hear him and my granddad talk about the things that were occurring in 1964. And you're right, there was racism was everywhere at that time, and everywhere. And so this older white guy with my granddad and John Washington worked together, and they worked together not as a black man and a white man, but they worked together as two people trying to enforce the law. And so they dealt with the issues that came up. And anytime I use any racist marks, any racist words, it's always in dialogue as people will use it. It's not thrown in there for shock value. I just want to show what it was like. I don't want to sugarcoat it. I don't want to make it any better or any worse than it was. But we all know that the civil rights, riots were going on in 64, 65. There was a lot happening. And that little community of Center Springs that I write about was a microcosm of the entire world. You're just so narrowly focused on those people as the outside influences would come in, and we can see how those individuals dealt with the world at large that was trying to intrude.
Well, Ned, as I'm reading the book, it strikes me as really quite a progressive guy for the time and place. As you said, he's working with John Washington, and that is a relationship where there's a mutual respect there, despite their different races. He's married to a Native American woman, and when push comes to shove, I mean, he doesn't seem to see the color. He sees the people, and for that time, again, he struck me as a very progressive kind of guy in the way he lived his life. He treated his field hands equally, no matter what race, and he seemed to treat them well, and a very admirable character, and I enjoy reading him.
Thank you. But my granddad was a Renaissance man. He was a man of few words for the most part. He liked to listen. But he just treated everyone as he wanted to be treated. He taught me that myself. I remember we had this old country store, the general store out on crossroads. And that's where you would go buy bread or whatever, the things that you didn't even get when you went to town. And there was a guy came through. I had seen him around town, and I'm 10 years old, somewhere in there. And I kind of made fun of the man, the way he walked and the way he spoke. He had a speech impediment. And my granddad pulled me off to the side and explained to me in no uncertain terms that you treat everyone alike, whether they're different or not, and you don't make fun of them. And that pretty well socked home with me. And so I wanted to bring those characteristics to the forefront of this character so that when you see Ned, you see he's kind of torn about some things. He's married to a full-blood Choctaw. My grandmother was Choctaw. I was grown when somebody mentioned to me that my grandparents were mixed marriage. It had never occurred to me because we are from Northeast Texas. There are a lot of Choctaws around there. The town is right on the Red River, and on the other side is the Choctaw territories of Oklahoma. So I would see these folks all the time, and they were the last of a breed. I distinctly remember in 1961 or 62 in the little town of Hugo, Oklahoma, seeing Choctaw Indian men and women walking on the streets of that small town. The women's dresses were almost to the ground. They were the old traditional style. It was a mix, and the men wore flat brimmed hats with high crowns walking around, and they had hair to their shoulders. I always thought that was fascinating. So I all this is set at the end of an era. It's a limbo. It's a gravitational issue right here. You have the past that is so strong. You have the technology that's coming in, and these people are caught between the two of those, trying to survive and make a living, as we said. So that's where Ned came from, and the characteristics that he has, and the characteristics that all the folks have in that part of the country.
You know, you talk about Ned and his progressivism and working with John Washington, and you described John as this big guy. He's wearing a badge, and yet he is, despite his relationship with Ned, he's keenly aware of the attitudes of some of the people that he's living with and dealing with, to the point where at a critical moment in the story, he's hesitant to walk into the front door of a cafe to speak to the judge, because he remembered an incident as a child where that didn't go over well. And so even this lawman is confronted with and dealing with these attitudes, which, as you say, were kind of evolving at the time, but still it was overt, and it plays a critical role in the story.
Yeah, a lot of that came from experience, from things that I'd seen growing up in that area. You know, African American folks were not allowed to come in the front door of a number of stores all the way up into the early 80s in some parts of rural Texas. And so I drew on those half stories or secondhand stories and remembrances, and included that in the rock hole, because, you know, John does have to walk a tight line. You know, he knows he and Ned are equals, but he knows that there are other people that look at him differently. And as you said, when he had to go in to deliver some news, he had to make a distinct decision based on the way of thinking at that time, whether or not to go barging into a whites only cafe, or to wait outside, or to find some other way to speak with who was inside the cafe. So, And John's, his role is to deal with his people, as he would put it, the people that live south of the tracks in the black section of the town. And so his job was to deal with his people because they would be more open to the law, a black man with a badge more open than the local racist sheriff that was there at the time also. Now, and again, we're speaking fiction here. I don't know who the sheriff was in Parrish, Texas in the 60s, but in my world, that's where he came from.
I actually saw a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel here, and you talk about attitudes evolving and things, and we say that sometimes it takes a crisis to move things forward. And what I saw is at the real climax in the crisis that confronted these people, the race kind of went aside. You have Sweet, an African-American midwife, who kind of takes control of the situation. You end up with John Washington inside Ned's house eating pie and drinking coffee, and field hands who may have felt put upon because of their race end up coming to support. So I kind of see that maybe people in the time of crisis really see people for people, and they do what needs to be done and set all those other underlying currents aside. And so I kind of took a positive out of that.
And thank you for that. That's as people realize the value of individuals and not the value of skin, they realize that John Washington is truly just a good man. And John helps Ned in a time of crisis when he really didn't have to do the things that he did, but because he's a good man, because children were in danger, everyone turns out together. And in small towns and rural towns, you know, there's when you get to know someone, you invite them into your home, and then you feed them. And that's what happened at the climax of the Rock Hole, when people that are of a different color than John Washington bring him into the house and say, "Thank you for all that you've done. Would you like to eat with us?" And once that barrier is down, then people begin to see each other as they truly are.
I don't want to give our listeners the impression that this book is entirely about racism in 1964 rural Texas. But again, it's an undercurrent in the people that runs through the book. But I want to talk about something a little more positive, and that's Top and Pepper and their relationship and how things. These are the cousins who are growing up together. They're close in age, and clearly they're important to one another. And you can see their relationship evolving in the book. And they're neat people.
Yeah, Top and Pepper are 10-year-olds, near twins. Top's real name is Terrence Oren Parker, but we love nicknames in Texas. And so they called him Top based on his initials. Pepper was based on a cousin, but that was just about as feisty and fun as Pepper is. Pepper's a female, Top's a male, and the two of them see this world, and you're right, it's not all about racism. It's about a changing world. It's about Pepper on a farm, and she wants to be in the city. Top is a city boy that has to come to live in the country. So they're diametrically opposed. And they're trying to figure out what's going on in this world. It's 1964. You know, Kennedy's gone now. The music is changing. These kids are inundated in music. Rock and roll was sweet rock and roll was giving away to the Beatles, which gave away to hard rock and revolutionary rock. And so what we see is in the Rock Hole, and as the series progresses, you see Top and Pepper struggling to deal with the changes that are around them, the music, the people, the news, but they're also dealing with the changes within themselves. They're 10 years old now. They're looking at the world a different way. Pepper is always getting into something, is what we would say around here. You know, she just likes to stir things up, whereas Top is a quiet kid and prefers to read, but he gets sucked into everything and all Pepper's little schemes and winds up coming. It all winds up working out well, but it's a challenge to both of them. It's truly a coming of age plot line within the novel.
And they're two kids that I am looking forward to learning more about as we go forward in the series. And Mr. Arribas, I want to thank you for joining us today. It's been great talking to you. I love the book. I'm happy that it was reissued. We will get it out there, and I'm going to recommend to everybody who's listening and our library patrons, come in, pick up a copy. It's about a place that we, as people that are living in this area, don't know about, and it's a great story. I look forward to reading the rest of the story. And the new one coming out in January is?
Laying Bones, and that's book 8 in the Red River series.
Well, I look forward to it. I thank you so, so much for joining us. And actually, before we leave, one last question, which I've been kind of bringing up as I've been talking to authors since the world went crazy in late February and March. How has this whole crazy pandemic impacted you, not personally, but as a writer? Has it led to any changes in plot lines, any storylines that you're thinking about? How does it impact you as a writer?
And as a writer, a lot of writers that I've gotten to know, we are pretty much introverts. We want to be home and we want to write. We do a lot of traveling to do signings or conferences, or I teach all over the country when people will bring me in to teach the art of writing. So that has changed. But what this lockdown and everything that's going on here at this tail end of 2020 has done for me, it has given me more opportunity to write at home instead of travel. I've written 3 complete manuscripts since March. One I wrote within 6 weeks, and you know, we're looking to getting that one out pretty soon. I have three other projects I'm working on. Each one of those, I'm about 20,000 words into each manuscript, and we'll see which one of those takes hold and carries me on. So it has given me a lot more time to write and to finish off my honey-do list that my wife always has for me when I wake up first thing in the morning.
Okay. Good answer. And again, thank you so much for joining us. I look forward to the rest of the series and keep them coming.
Barney, thank you so much. It's an honor and a privilege. I appreciate you, sir.
We appreciate it. And with that, let's turn the page on this chapter of the Syosset Library Podcast.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.